This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM dial, or 3CR Digital, or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael. And today we've asked our guest, Lynn, to share their experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. And before we do that, I'd just like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm or family violence, so please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks for asking me to share.
No, it's great that you could join us in the studio. And we'd like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Lynn?
Oh, it was great. I had a fabulous childhood. I learned to read when I was about three, and there were always books in the house because I had older siblings and we had a library. And I was the youngest in a big family, and I had a very, very happy time as a reading child. Yeah, it was good.
So you grew up in Melbourne, did you grow up?
No, I grew up in country Victoria, and my parents met about 3 minutes after the war, and then they married and had a lot of kids, and they never had any money. I don't know how they did it when I look back at it as an adult, but my childhood was very, very trouble-free.
Okay. Siblings?
Yeah, I had heaps of siblings. I had siblings who
heaps.
Were... I'm one of seven.
Wow.
And I had a lot of sisters, and I had one brother who was next to me in the lineup, and lots of fun, lots of laughter. My parents were both frustrated, clever kids whose lives didn't allow them to you know, finish school and become something else. So they were very oriented on school. You had to be really sick to get a day off school when I was a kid, really sick. But I was a successful, clever student, so I love going to school as well.
Oh, cool. Mm. And so how long did you spend in country Victoria?
All my childhood I spent in country Victoria, and then there was some family, chasms, things emerged in my family, and my father started doing crazy geographicals, which, of course, at the time we didn't think of as geographicals, you know, running away from yourself. And so then my very easygoing childhood suddenly became metropolitan and difficult.
Yeah. How old were you then?
I was about 12 or so. And, yeah, so I went from being a really good, well-behaved, biddable kid who only cared that teachers liked her to being a teenage ratbag. In the space of about, I don't know, 6 or 12 months, I suddenly turned into a feral teenager.
Wow. And
so the transition was pretty complete.
So that would have coincided with the changing from primary school into secondary school?
Yeah, yeah. I only lasted a couple of years at secondary school before I became a ratbag kid. But I would just like to put in a plug for returning to school, because that is what I did at the other end of my teenage years. So if you didn't finish school, you can go back. You can find somewhere and you can go back and you can do it in the year that you do it. You don't have to do it when you're 16 or 17.
So what did being a ratbag kid look like? What did it actually entail?
Oh, dear. Well, it entailed disconnecting myself from my family, also known as running away from home, staying in touch with siblings. I was very lucky I had older siblings. They pulled me out of a lot of difficult situations, and generally assuming that I'd be okay. And Lord, I don't know how I was. You know, I don't know how I survived it, really. But then I discovered alcohol.
Yeah. Did you have alcoholism in your family?
My mother never drank, and my father didn't drink for most of my childhood. My father, it just wasn't sort of financially possible, or, you know, he couldn't fit it in, I think. So there wasn't explicit alcoholism in my family. It was sort of later that I realised the patterns of it. But I discovered it for myself, really. And it was fabulous pain relief. That's how I saw it when I was a very young kid, a very underage drinker. I saw it as pain relief.
How old were you when you first started drinking?
I was about 13. And I, as I said, my parents were non-drinkers. I had never been in a pub. I'd never seen drinking. I'd never had conversations about it. And yet, somehow, when I found myself in the back lounge of the Rosebud Hotel, age 13, I had the presence of mind to order a double gin.
What else would you have? As a 13-year-old, you go, yeah, I'm going to go double gin.
Yeah, I went double. You know, how the hell did I even know doubles were a thing? But I did.
Yeah, someone had shown you.
Someone had shown me.
You'd seen it happen somewhere. Mm. It seems to be the age, doesn't it? 13 is it like if we can say that we both do Alcoholics Anonymous, and 13 seems to be a popular age for people to start drinking, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah, it's not normal at all. I speak to other people and
it's not normal.
It's and we've joked about before the show, we held out as long as we could. We started at 13. Mm. Okay. And so what happened when you had your first drink? Like, was there consequences for the first time you had a double gin?
I don't remember consequences then, but what I remember about that time is that it was pain relief, you know, because I was in the big wide world and that was harder than I had imagined, and it helped with the pain. I thought it was bloody marvellous.
Mm.
I thought it was, you know, I thought it was the solution.
Absolutely. Mm. And gin's not like a flavoursome drink. It's not the sort of thing you go, well, I drank it for the taste.
I drank for effect. I always have drunk for effect.
Yeah, and so
I drank tomorrow, it would be for effect.
You bet. I have that feeling about smoking, actually. I've given up smoking. I know that if I was to take a cigarette tomorrow, I'd be smoking it for the mind-altering effect that it would have. But the did it work the first time around? Like, what was the experience you had? Did you pass out? Did you throw up? What happened?
Honestly, I don't remember. I don't remember what happened. I just remember that it eased my path.
But you were going to do it again.
Oh, bloody oath!
How long did that take, do you reckon, to have the next time?
I would imagine the next day.
Wow.
Yeah, I was dedicated. I joined the club.
How did you finance that?
Oh, I had little jobs. I don't think I used to, when I was a young kid, I used to think that paying rent was sort of optional.
Absolutely.
It was a good thing to do. I wasn't against paying rent. But if I had to prioritise buying a new frock and buying a drink, I certainly did.
Mm. Yeah, I get that. I lived in share houses that somehow the rent never got paid by me because drinking became too important.
Mm.
And so, what was the progression like? You started to drink in an adult type way in some ways.
Yes,
as a child.
Yeah, I did drink in an adult type way before I had an adult's body and brain.
And so, what did that look like? What happened then? Did it affect your health? Did it put you in situations where you were, you
it certainly
didn't want
put
to be...
me in situations. Yes, it put me in situations that that were problematic. I don't remember it affecting my health, you know, for years. I never had hangovers or anything. No, it didn't make me sick. It might make me embarrassed or remorseful or regretful or anxious, but it didn't make me physically unwell.
Yep. Mm. And so you continued to drink like that for a period of time. Did you got through your teen years, or did you maintain a particular way of drinking, or did it get worse quickly? Or
I think I was always the same kind of drinker, which was dedicated. I think it was always part of my life. I socialised with people who drank. I thought it was odd to socialise with people who didn't. As I said earlier, I knew that I was a clever kid, and I missed learning. You know, when I was a young kid at primary school, I was deeply impressed by the teachers. I thought, you know, they knew so much, and they had such strong voices. I used to be really impressed by teaching when I was, and when older siblings used to bag out teachers, I used to be unable to join in. So I liked teaching. I liked learning. I liked that sort of place to be. So I went back to study. I did my year 12 as a young adult, you know, end of my teenage years, and then I went to uni. Thank you, Gough Whitlam, for paying me to do that. And at uni, I discovered the group of people who drank straight away. That was the first thing I did, was find the drinkers and find the pub. Yep. We used to drink at PA's, Prince Alfred, and that was, you know, that was they were the people I hung out with at uni.
Yeah, and so and where were you living at this stage?
I was living in East St Kilda then.
Okay, so you're in Melbourne.
I was in Melbourne by then. Yes.
Yeah, cool. And in, you know, living with anybody in particular, family? Or?
Oh, look, I was, when I look back on my time as a tearaway teen, I was very fortunate that I had a boyfriend who wasn't violent, wasn't nasty, wasn't unkind, wasn't coercive, and when I think of it now, almost did a bit of parenting of me as well. I was very fortunate.
Yeah, and so, okay, so the talk about what happened when it started to get worse. What happened in your life?
It was often worse in the sense that it was often embarrassing. You know, there were often things that I was inappropriately drunk, or I fell over and blacked my eye out by banging my head on the curb, or I knew I'd said something stupid, but I couldn't remember what, that kind of thing. So it was often socially unpleasant. But I just thought, well, I don't know what I thought. I just thought, that's the price to pay. That doesn't matter. I need some anaesthetic to help me think about yesterday, and I knew what the anaesthetic was.
And then, so my experience with that stuff is that my self-esteem is eroded through that behaviour. So what bravado, what sort of things, how do you put up a wall to make it okay?
Find a new suburb to live in. That was a good solution. Find a new pub to drink in, new set of friends, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I definitely identify that. I have experience of dumping friends groups and moving on.
That was easier than facing a talk about what I'd said or done.
Okay, so you're a bit transient and you're moving from place to place?
Yeah, I was in those years, yeah. Mm.
Okay, and so when did it come, what age were you when it became unacceptable, when something happened and you went, actually, I can't do this?
Oh, no, that happened years later, Michael. That cool. was years into my drinking that I had that thought.
So what happened in the meantime? You went to uni, you said?
I went to uni, I found work, I got married and had a couple of kids. All of those things happened. And in those years, I drank a lot less. But, you know, in AA, sometimes you will hear people say that when they drink, they can't guarantee their behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
There was always that awareness inside my head that I could control my drinking. I wanted to control my drinking. I wanted to be seen as a grown-up and not a useless drunk. But I also knew that on any given night or outing or excursion or important event, I may not be able to be good. Yeah.
And did that stop you from doing stuff?
No. I mean, it stopped me from public drinking, I guess. But, I, you know, maybe I did fewer things because I didn't want to do them publicly, but it never stopped me drinking. Nothing stopped me drinking.
Oh, no, but so did it mean that you put barriers in your life? Like, I know for me, I stopped drinking with other people because I know that all of a sudden, my social drinking becomes antisocial drinking because I'm spending time drinking by myself, because I know what happens when I drink is that there's a good chance I'm about to blow up this relationship, or I'm about to make a fool of myself, or I'm about to do something because the only thing I can guarantee when I have a drink is that I'm going to have another drink.
Yes. Yeah, I always preferred drinking on my own, because I could drink at the rate I wanted to, and, that was it, really. It was about rates of drinking.
Yep.
How many glasses could I fit in? That never looked good socially.
No.
And in the outside world, yeah. I always thought it was a bit odd that you'd hear people say never drink alone, and I'd think, well, why not?
Mm.
Best way to do it.
Yeah, it's listen to music. My experience of living in share houses is I never come out of the room.
Mm.
Everything I own is in that room, and there's a bar fridge probably, and everything. If I had a doorway into that room that didn't require me to go anywhere through the rest of the house, that's fine too.
Perfect. Yeah,
perfect life. So we might take a break and we'll play some music and we'll come back afterwards to talk about what happened next.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
That was a song used to get high for a living by John Butler Trio. You're listening to 3CR, to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on AM, 3CR on digital radio, or maybe streaming on 3cr.org.au. We would encourage our listeners to become a regular donor to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor, or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking to Lynn about alcoholism and her recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. And before the break, you gave us some insight into your introduction to alcohol, and maybe we'll move forward a little bit in time and see where you're at when alcohol became troublesome.
Okay. Look, I do remember that when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard people describe it as a progressive disease. And I remember thinking, well, that explains the last 5, 8, 10 years. But, you know, there was a long period of time before I came into AA where I just kept stuffing up, you know, again and again. I kept letting my kids down. I'd be late for work. I wouldn't go to work. I'd be inappropriately pissed at a social gathering, you know, because I'd preloaded. The need for it, the absolute solid need for it, became all consuming, and I was still totally committed. I was still on board. I still thought that for this life, you know, for this being, alcohol was still necessary. I couldn't imagine not being a drinker, but you know, things just got worse and worse. I was embarrassed all the time. I was anxious all the time. I wanted to convince myself that nobody else was noticing how bad it was getting. But you know, I knew that that was unconvincing. Now and again, I'd talk to my doctor. I had a lovely GP, a really decent human being. And now and again, I would talk to him, and he'd say encouraging things like, "You'll be dead when you're 50. And I'd sort of think, oh, that'll be awful. But that didn't, you know, now and again.
It's a long way, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
But it's not tomorrow.
It's not tomorrow. I would occasionally go and see a counsellor. I remember going and seeing an AOD counsellor. And, you know, and I would tell these people about 25% of the truth. I didn't want to overload them with too much truth. I also didn't want them to tell me that I shouldn't drink. So I had to be quite circumspect. You know, I want your help, I want your advice, but I don't want you to tell me to stop. So I'd go and see a person who told me I needed 12 sessions and I'd have one. session and tell them half the story, and then I'd think, right, well, I've done something about my drinking. I made my family very unhappy. I was the biggest problem in my kids' lives. And, you know, that, and I knew that. I could see that in their faces. I could hear it from their anger. But I still kept thinking, I wish I hadn't done that. I've been like that, but now I need a drink to help myself feel better. So it got pretty awful. It got pretty awful, and it stayed awful for quite a while.
Did you try to stop? Did you try ways of stopping, or was that not even an option?
I'd stop as long as I could keep drinking. That was how fried my brain was, you know? So that, I couldn't stop, basically. I could tell myself I was stopping, or I was going to stop, or I'd had less today than I'd had yesterday. But I was not a person who could stop. So it wasn't going to be a great outcome. I could see that. And then, look, I was sick, I was mad, I was broke. They got really angry with me at work, and I had a job that I loved doing, and they told me, my boss had told me to F off and not come back. And I was the queen of denial, but I couldn't deny what had been said to me. You know, I was no longer fit to go to work, to do a job I loved. And
How old were you then?
I was about 41, 42.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my older siblings had joined AA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard that on the family tom-toms, and mm-hmm. I'd been really sad about it when I heard that because I thought, oh, what a bugger, now I'm going to have to avoid that sibling.
Get that.
Because I don't want to catch any AA germs from them. And then, look, I wasn't able to work, I wasn't able to function, you know, I'd gone, it had gone beyond okay. My mother, who was well into her 70s, was getting the train across town to cook my kids' dinner and clean the house up. I mean, for Christ's sake, I still needed my mother to feed my kids. And my older sibling, who was an AA member, rang me and said, would I do something for her? And I mean, in my head, I'm thinking, you know, does she need some cash, or does she need me to pick her up from the airport? Nobody would ask me to pick them up from the airport.
No.
Nobody. But I'm still thinking I'm showing a good show. And my sister said to me, would you please go to 2 AA meetings? And we joked about it later because she said she thought one mightn't be enough. And the miracle is that the next morning, instead of me waking up and thinking, is there anaesthetic, for which we might call Chardonnay, is there some in the cupboard, in the fridge, in the car, or when does the bottle shop open, or, you know, how soon can I start anaesthetising for what happened yesterday, I got up and had a shower and went to a meeting.
Wow.
And I had to get to Ivanhoe from where I live in Melbourne's West, which was really hard for me to
in
work
the morning,
out.
That's a Tuesday.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That was my first meeting. And I had to drive around the zoo, and then there's some place where the road, Heidelberg Road, splits, and I always get muddled around there. And anyway, I got to the meeting.
Good place to be.
It was a good place to be.
Absolutely. It certainly was early days for me. That was a meeting that I used to do in the morning to start my head.
Yeah, good way to start the day.
Yeah, cool. So what did you hear when you, in your first couple of meetings, you were set the task of doing a couple of meetings?
Yeah. The next one I went to was in the gallery in town. But I don't remember hearing much in that meeting, the first meeting I went to, because my head was, you know, I was fried. I was in a bad way. And I couldn't make out much of the words in the funny font on the wall. But I'll tell you what I noticed. I noticed that the people in the meeting were clean, in clean clothes, with clean hair that they had brushed, and they were happy to be there, and they were happy to see each other, and they were just looking like people who could bear to be in their own skin. And I was so full of shame and loathing for what I'd been doing. I could just see the difference.
Mm. I remember watching the older people get up that staircase and thinking in that meeting, and because there was a really steep staircase that took you upstairs to that room. It was sort of like an amphitheatre almost in that hallway, and they had the tea and the coffee across the back and in the old bank building. And just watching and being impressed by the fact that these people who, like I think it was a woman named Joyce, and
yes.
And who's now passed, and listening to her story about how what happened with her kids and yes. getting her kids back and stuff, and I in tears at the early days, listening to these people tell these stories, but and thinking how much hope there was in that room, and then watching these, I said these, I was about the same age as you, and you know, in my early 40s, and doing this going, oh my God, there's hope here. There's definitely that these people are managing to do this.
And I'll tell you something about that older sober member, Joyce. I had rung AA's Melbourne phone number to find out where I could go to a meeting. And Joyce answered. She was on duty that day. And she said to me that she would be at the meeting the next day. I'm tearing up thinking about this. And she was there. And she said, if you come to the meeting tomorrow, I'll give you a hug. And she was there and she hugged me. She kept to her word. And I had been avoiding getting close to people for quite a long time, partly because I always smelled of grog, but also partly because I had a lot of shame about my behaviour. And I, you know, I never felt like I deserved people being hugging me. And Joyce hugged me that day. And then she said, just sit down and we'll get you a cup of tea.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a wonderful, just, it's what, I think 12-step programs do. They reach out to people on day one and they just give you what you need. And, yeah, it was really lovely.
It's interesting. Yeah, that was the first place I went for coffee. Like I'd never going to have coffee with any of these people, right? And I just remember that Tuesday morning meeting was definitely they went across the road into a cafe in the shopping centre or on the corner sort of thing.
Mm.
And we all sat down and I with all these people I didn't know, and sat down and had a cup of coffee and listened to these people smiling and laughing and when I'm talking to them I get that their lives aren't perfect, but they're nowhere near as miserable as I am.
That's right.
And it was okay for me to be miserable around them, and they were willing to listen to my rubbish. Like the when I look back now, I look back at all the problems in my life I had created, and they were willing to listen to me as a new person sitting in this room, and, you know, in that room with them, and down in that having a coffee with them and going, yep, come back tomorrow. We'll see you. We're going to be going such and such on Wednesday, or we're going to be there on Thursday, and finding a space to be.
Mm.
And that's, yeah, that's certainly my experience of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I found a tribe. Long time I'd been looking for some people who, you know, to sit there in a room of people where they're telling these horror stories and be nodding my head and going, oh, my goodness, I identify with all this stuff. I may not have done all the things that they're doing, but gee, I identify with the feelings and the thinking and the putting my family second. You know, absolutely. You know, the alcohol came first, and I feel so much shame around that.
Yeah. So from there, I joined AA. I found a home group, and that was interesting because it was I was the only woman in that group for a long time. And, you know, it was and on paper, you know, I'd be looking for the feminist collective AA. But I needed the wisdom of those male people. You know, they were straight talkers. They welcomed me. They made me part of the group. They offered, you know, they gave me their phone numbers and said, if you ever feel like drinking or if you ever feel terrible, you can ring me. And I remember, you know, I remember getting a credit card bill and just, you know, feeling waves of anxiety, and I was off the grog, so I couldn't use the old pain relief, and so I rang one of the members of that group, and he read me the prayer about, you know, fear of economic insecurity and uncertainty will leave us, and just said, you'll be all right, you'll pay it off eventually, and the crisis passed. Mm. So it was wonderful joining that home group. And I learned about alcoholism by going to AA. I learned that it was a disease. I learned that I'd been a walk-up start to it because of my DNA, who knows. But I learned that people like me, once they start, they can't stop. The only thing that matters when you're having a drink is the next drink. I learned that it wasn't a matter of shame or choice, and I joined a tribe. You know, all that nodding that people in 12-step programs do when somebody shares and everybody nods because they know what happens when you're in that place. And in that time, I was 3 years in then with the same home group and I got sobriety and I began to get recovery. And people used to come into meetings and I'd hear them say, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so and I'm back after a bust of drinking. And I used to think, why would you go out and drink again? I couldn't imagine it. I thought the joy I had from discovering that I didn't need to drink a day at a time was amazing for me, and that I could suddenly, not suddenly, but eventually I could be a reliable adult behaving like an adult in the world as long as I didn't drink a day at a time. It was beyond joyous for me. It really was. And when other people used to come into the program, into meetings and say, I had a drink yesterday or I'm back from a bust, I used to think, why would you do that? Mm. Why would you drink again?
I guess that's what powerless is, isn't it?
That's what powerless is, you know. And then I drank again after 3 years. Mm. I stopped going to meetings. I prioritized other things in my life. And people, in case you're listening, I am not recommending having a bust, okay? I'm telling you this because this is an honest program and I need to be honest, and not because I want you to think that you can go out and drink again and come back and it'll be all right. I don't want you to think that. You don't have to drink. You don't have to drink today. You don't have to drink tomorrow. But I got it into my head that I didn't need to go to meetings and hang out with other sober members of AA. I got it into my head that I could put other things in place. And I guess I began imagining that I was recovered. Mm. Turned out I wasn't. Because when things went wrong, a tiny, tiny little memory niggled at the back of my brain. When things were unpleasant and unhappy, my brain reminded me that I had pain relief in the form of dry white wine.
Mm.
And I suddenly found myself in a pub ordering it.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow.
Amazingly bad. You know, it was amazing how the feeling the thought I imagined would never come back.
How long did that last? Did you get that bust?
Oh, way too long, Michael. I kept drinking and not drinking, being in the fellowship and not in the fellowship for a number of years.
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't recommend it. At one stage I went and got a job in Darwin, and I do not recommend the top end of Australia for people who are trying to stay sober a day at a time. That didn't help me one iota, just for the record. Mm. Not that it was anyone's fault in Darwin.
No.
I was the one who ordered the plonk. So it was like I had two heads for a while. I had the AA head that wanted sobriety and recovery and fellowship of people, and then the other one who wanted the secret drink. Oh, my God, it was awful. Anyway, I finally had what sometimes is called a moment of clarity.
Mm.
And that moment of clarity was, if you don't stop, if you don't go back to AA and stay in AA, you will die the mad, crazy drunk, and you will not be remembered for your 3 years of sobriety.
Mm.
You'll remember it as somebody that we're quite glad is 6 foot under now because she was causing so much trouble.
Wow.
And I just had a moment of that. Mm.
That's a great place to head off. We're going to go and listen to a song and we'll come back and talk about what it looks like now.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Throughout September, we're asking you to become a regular donor. By setting up an ongoing automatic monthly donation, you'll help provide a stable foundation for 3CR. If we know we can count on your donation every month, it means we can better plan and resource our broadcasting. Whether it's First Nations justice, workers' rights, climate action, independent music, housing advocacy, or disability activism, your regular support ensures that these movements and struggles have a platform every single week. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, regular donors are vital to keeping us on air. If you're willing to become a regular donor, please go to 3cr.org.au or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with Lynn about alcoholism and her recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. And just before the break, you talked about, you know, the bust after 3 years, and you're back. Come back in, after a period of time, after a moment of clarity. And what's it look like now? What have you done to stay sober?
Oh, well, what it looks like now is great, and that's because I've done stuff to stay sober. I remember that day that I had that insight into what my future would be. And I rushed into a meeting that I was driving to, and I said to an older sober woman, please help me get through the steps, because I hadn't done the steps, the 12 steps of recovery. And so she said yes, and we went through the literature together. We read about recovery, and we did those 12 steps in order. And in case it's of use to you to know, since I did the steps, I haven't had a drink. I haven't had a craving for a drink. I don't think a drink will fix anything in my life. And I live life without that thought that a drink would help or make things better. So, you know, if you're wondering whether the steps are worth going through and you want sobriety and recovery, it's definitely worth the time and the hard work and the honest discussion.
Mm. Yeah. I think that the way I've heard it described is that it's really important that I'm sober and happy, and because it's really difficult to be sober and miserable, and that's what going on the wagon looks like, and I need to have a process. My experience with the steps is it distracts me from my life. My sponsor calls it spiritual acupuncture, and he had a shoulder reconstruction, and they took away the pain in his shoulder by putting a needle in his toe. And it didn't look like it should work, and the pain went away, and that's what the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me too. That I have a problem, and my job is not to look at the problem. My job is to do what AA tells me to do, which is to think of others and take my time to look at helping other people and being useful to other people. And what happens is my problems die of neglect.
I do remember you've reminded me, the word service that you mentioned, Michael, has reminded me that when I first came in for the first time, I remember when I'd been, you know, around meetings for 2 or 3 weeks, somebody gave me a tea towel and said, we do service. And I said, what do you mean? And the person said, if you dry the dishes, you're doing service to AA and it'll make you more sober and better. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not doing that. You
know? What's it for me?
I was too special to dry cups or something or other. And it took me a while to realise that service, you know, the service keeps us sober is what you hear people say.
Yeah.
And now I do service. You know, I help others when I can. I set up meetings. I go to meetings. I have discussions with other people in my home group about what will make our meeting more useful for newcomers. Mm. And I talk to people. And I'm very fortunate that I get the chance to do that because, as you say, if you're helping someone else, you're actually not thinking how hard done by you are. So I'm, you know, I'm pretty lucky. The other thing I want to say about a 12-step program and meetings, which something I did not expect to happen at all, is that it's funny. You get a laugh. It's really hilarious when people stand up and share their experience and strength and hope. And the same for me, you know. And one of the reasons I like going to meetings is that I come out lighter because I've been with people like me who understand my story and they've also made me laugh. And, you know, there's a phrase in the Big Book, we are not a glum lot. And it really is a place of honesty and hope and humour. And I didn't bargain for that. I thought, you know, when I decided to avoid my older sibling because they'd got sober, I was not aware that it was going to be a fun place to be. So, yeah.
I think you think that people are going to be sitting around about the great sacrifice they've made to not drink. And,
yeah.
And really what's happened is that, well, my experience is that life has opened up.
Absolutely.
And all these things, all these opportunities have come, which I would have just missed.
Yeah.
Because they never would have been on, they might have been right in front of my face and I never would have seen them because I'm blinded to opportunities because I'm so focused on me and how I'm going to get the next drink and what and the miserable, the misery that I've created in my life is dominating my life. And then through recovery, what's happened is that, you know, that all these, a lot of the circus is still happening inside my head and I get a laugh about that, but it's not playing out in the lives of other people.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. And I you've reminded me that when I was a drinker, I used to imagine if I didn't have a drink, people would think that was odd. You know, what if I went out for a meal or a in a bar or something and I said, I'll have a soda and lime, you know, people would think that was very strange. What I notice in sobriety is nobody gives a rat's patootie what I'm drinking. You know, it just does not matter. I'll just say I'm a water drinker, thanks, and the waiter takes my wine glass away. You know? Whereas when I imagined giving up drinking, I thought that was going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I worried about that.
Forehead.
Yeah. But no, I love not drinking. And I remember in early meetings, I heard a woman stand up and say, you know, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic and I'm gratefully sober today. And I remember thinking, how could you put grateful and sober in the same sentence? How could you say that, I thought. You know, I was about a week sober. I was a week without a drink. I wasn't a week sober. I just hadn't had a drink for a week. And I just thought that was an impossible way to feel about recovery and sobriety and what AA programs like Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. And now I am one of those people who is gratefully sober today because it's given me everything else.
Yeah.
It's given me a world I could not have imagined. And it's given my family someone to love, not someone to put up with.
I think they say that, that we give offered life beyond our wildest dreams.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
And really all that's happened is that my dreams have changed. And you know, what I thought was important is no longer important. And
yeah.
And all these things that I never really knew were important are now happening in my life. And I go, that's important.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing that sobriety's given me, yeah. And, you know, when I got so sick and so mad and things were so terrible for my family and for me, I did not imagine that I'd be able to give up drinking. I did not imagine myself as a person who could not drink until I ended up in AA. And the other people in meetings taught me that I didn't need to drink a day at a time. And it's still that for me. It's still meetings, other people, and the fact that all I have to do is not do it today. And you know, it was way simpler than I thought. I thought it was an impossible task for this person to be a non-drinker. And now I'm just a happy, grateful non-drinker a day at a time.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for your time today and coming in to share your experience. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-222-222 or you can go online to aa.org.au. Yeah, thanks to Lynn for coming in and sharing her story and in the studio. And thank you. That was awesome. And I hope that you'll be able to join us next week when Anne will be speaking to Glenda about the recovery in Al-Anon family groups. And coming up next, we have Balamoir, the Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Talcum, Dalgam Choco Edwards and join Uncle Choco in the spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. 3CR. Also, yeah, so thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned. Now for more Radical Radio on 3CR, and we'll take us out with some more music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.